Okay, we are just coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, remute yourself afterwards so we keep our background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck being presented in PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat will go up on our website, probably about an hour or so after the Q&A session. So again, welcome to any new people we have with us tonight. If you want to join, paste it into the chat where you can go. You can also just go to our homepage and then click the Join or Renew button at the top, and that'll lead you through to the process. You can pay by a number of different means, and it's just $20 per year. And so we have a fair amount of material tonight, but we probably will have time for the final 10 as well. So I will toss it over to Alan.
Okay, I think the same thing. We have some prepared topics, but if everybody remembers, or if you're new, you won't remember, but we try to reserve the last 10 minutes or so for your questions or topics or just general discussion. And so we'll hopefully get to that in about 40 minutes. In the meantime, I have a quick share here. I thought this was kind of interesting, a cautionary note on artificial intelligence. I think we all know that AI is not necessarily to be trusted. Now, this is kind of interesting. Some researchers in Sweden, if I remember rightly, decided that they would create a fake disease. These are medical researchers. So they created a fake disease and then basically posted it to see what would happen with the chatbot. But they included in their paper, they said that they had a colleague from the Starfleet Academy. They thanked the University of the Fellowship of the Ring for funding for the project. And at some point in the early text, they said, this entire paper is made up. Now, that didn't stop anybody doing anything. The AI bots still found it and reported it as factual. Okay, so Chris, you've got flight control on this one.
Yes, I do. Thank you. So this came up, I guess it was after last week's Q&A, or maybe even 2 weeks ago. There was some talk about Windows Clipboard, so I thought I would do a little bit more comprehensive look at the Windows Clipboard and where we stand now with it. It's been around for a long time, since Windows 1.0, released November 20th of 1985. And so the way it works is you can copy an item, either text or graphics, to the clipboard. And so basic process is you select the item you want copied, you press Control-C, or usually there's a menu option, Edit, Copy, and sometimes there will be a toolbar item if you have a toolbar interface to it. And click, come on. So then you go to paste the item to a new location. It can be a different program or a different location in the same program. And you press Control-V or a menu option is usually there, Edit, Paste, or you might have a toolbar item with a paste option on it. And the thing with the Windows Clipboard, for the longest time, it was a single item buffer. So it was in memory, and when you copied something to the clipboard, it remained in the buffer until something else got copied to the clipboard or the computer got rebooted. And any new item that you click, Control-C or the Edit, Copy, or toolbar item, where you go to copy, it will replace the first item that was in the buffer. So then we had multi-item clipboards, and this was first introduced in Windows in Office 2000. They introduced the Office clipboard around mid-1999, and it could store up to 24 items that you copy to the clipboard in a first-in, first-out queue. And there are third-party clipboard managers, and there are some that still exist to this day, and they usually add on some extra things. You get history, search, things like that. In Windows 10, in October 2018 update, which was version 1809, it introduced clipboard history. and that allows you to store up to 25 clipboard items in a first-in, first-out buffer, and you can actually pin items to the clipboard history so that they remain available until you unpin them, so they stop being part of that first-in, first-out buffer and are just stuck there until such time as you actually unpin them. And clipboard history across devices was also introduced then. So it was also known as Cloud Clipboard, and it allowed you to copy onto the clipboard on one computer and then paste it to a computer on another computer. So how you work with it, you enable clipboard history. So you go to Settings, System, Clipboard, and you toggle it on clipboard history. I believe it's off by default. And it tells you there the Windows V will be used to view your clipboard and paste any of the items that are actually on there. So how do you actually use clipboard history? So after you copy something to the clipboard using any of the methods at your disposal, you then go where you want to paste the item. And rather than pressing Control V, you press Win V. And it'll actually bring up a dialog box which shows you all of the items that's in your clipboard history. And the most recently copied is at the top. And all you have to do is you can scroll down with your arrows or you can just click on the entry you want to paste. And there is a scroll bar on the right-hand side if you have items that are not visible currently. So you arrow to it and press enter or just click on the item that you actually want. Here's an example where we have, we're seeing one entry, which is some text, and one entry, which is a graphic that has been pasted onto the clipboard history. And you also have a menu. So you can go to the clipboard history in the meatball menu, the three horizontal dots. And if you click on that, you will then get a little dialog box pop up where it allows you to select a couple of different things. So there's options for paste as text. So by default, everything that goes on to clipboard history will be in a rich text format. So it will contain font information, bolding, underlining, colors, things like that in text. So if all you want to do is paste as text, you can go to that menu, and then you go to the left-hand item, which has a little clipboard with an A on it, and as they hover over it, it tells you that's going to be the paste as text. You can also delete something off of the clipboard history, either if you have sensitive information that you've copied to the clipboard and you don't want it remaining on there, you could delete it, or maybe it's taking up a lot of memory and you just want to free up the memory, you could delete an item off of it if you want. So if you wanted to pin items, this is useful if you want to keep items on the clipboard history basically forever or until you unpin it. So the normal operation is 25 items in first in, first out, but if you pin an item, it will prevent it from being flushed from the buffer. And then that little pin will show as a black pin when it has been pinned, and if you want to unpin it, you click on it, and then it'll go to the unpin stage. Eventually, the pinned items will migrate down to the bottom because it's always in that most recent, that top list.
Chris, before you go on,
sure.
First in, first out is right. Steve's asking if it isn't last in, first out.
Yeah, I guess it is, yeah. Last in will be last out because it will not get flushed. The last one put in there, it won't get flushed until the other 24.
If you enter like four or five things into the clipboard, the most recent one is the last one, and that's the one that it'll paste. So it's the last one in is the first one out.
I'm talking about it getting flushed from the buffer.
Basically getting deleted. The oldest item gets deleted first.
Okay, and then the final thing that I want to talk about is the clipboard history across devices. So this is kind of a cool item. So you go to the Settings Clipboard, System Clipboard, and you have to toggle that on. So it's called Clipboard History Across Your Devices. It used to be known as Cloud Clipboard. And then if you copy text to the clipboard on one computer, you can go to another computer, and then it will appear in clipboard history on the second computer, and you can paste it where you want on the second computer. Kind of cool. But there are some limitations to it. First off, talking about automatic versus manual synchronization. So if you go to the settings system clipboard history across devices, there are two options you have available, automatic sync or manual sync. And so automatic sync means that if both computers are set up to enable clipboard history across devices, then as soon as you copy text to the clipboard on the first computer, it will be appearing on the clipboard history on the second computer. On the other hand, if you choose manual sync, the text copied to the clipboard, it will only happen when you go to clipboard history on the first computer and you click the dot, dot, dot menu and you choose the sync button. So some clipboard limitations. So the clipboard can actually have text and graphics, and there are some special formats that are defined by the program that is adding data to the clipboard. The clipboard itself can hold basically anything. So it's the program that you're copying data to the clipboard that is going to define what the data is that gets copied to the clipboard. There's no practical limit on the size to available RAM and virtual memory. And what that comes down to is in a 32-bit process, which is the smallest data set that can be done on a Windows computer, it's about 2 gigabytes worth of data that can be copied to the clipboard. So it's way, way beyond that on a 64-bit process if you have it running on your computer. Clipboard history is a little bit more limitations. So you can have text and graphics. It excludes most of the special formats and data types. So you'll have just graphics and plain text, or formatted text, I should say, gets copied to there. So some of the special formats that can go onto the clipboard are things like copying a file in File Explorer. So if in File Explorer you select a file and you do Control-C and then you go somewhere else in the file system, you can do a Control-V to paste that. And that's a special data format that Windows understands, and that won't get copied to clipboard history. And there is a size limit of about 4 megabyte size limit per item that gets put onto clipboard history. And it is that 25 items in that revolving buffer. You get a little bit more limitations when it comes to clipboard history across your devices. First off, any of the computers participating in this have to be signed into using a Microsoft account on both the computers. It is text only, so no graphics across there at all. And then, quote unquote, Microsoft says less than 100K size limit. And in my experience of trying this out, I found that I could only get about 50K in my testing in order to have it work across the clipboard. Otherwise, if it was over that on my computers, it just seems to just ignore it. It doesn't show up on the clipboard history on the other computer. And that's all I have for there.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Okay, next up I have a little item here on customizing the desktop. I flagged this one as computer basics. It's pretty basic stuff, and I imagine everybody knows about it, but just in case you don't, here's some of the things that I do with the desktop. The main thing is I use two monitors. So I have a laptop computer where I'm running the slideshow. I have a secondary computer where I'm actually displaying the slides in presenter view that you're viewing tonight. So I'm looking at kind of PowerPoint and you're looking at the actual output from the file. And the way I do that is by extending the desktop. So if you have a second monitor, you can do two things basically. You can duplicate the displays, so the main display shows up exactly the same on the second display, so the display is duplicated. Or you can extend the main desktop, and so the second monitor basically becomes a bigger area that's kind of attached to the main desktop. So you end up with basically more working area on your desktop. And the beauty of that is that you can run, in addition to running PowerPoint in presentation mode, you can run different applications on the two screens. So I could have I could have a word processor running in one screen and a spreadsheet running on the other, or I could be reading my email on the other. So I have several different applications on the different screens. And the other neat thing is you can drag a window, especially an application, you can drag a window from one screen to the other. So it becomes very convenient for managing all kinds of things. So if you right-click on the desktop, and in the context menu that pops up, you select Display Settings, you'll see this window. And if you use the drop-down menu there for multiple displays, you can see that you've got the option to duplicate the displays or extend the displays, which is the thing that I typically use. And clearly you can show on one or the other as well if you wish, but you've got two monitors, you might as well use them both. So essentially you end up with this. Here's my two monitors side by side. This is actually a screenshot. So the main display on the laptop is on the left with all the various icons. And on the right-hand side, I'm running, I guess that's PowerPoint. You're looking at the slide presentation that I'm actually showing. And as I say, what I could do is I could grab PowerPoint here, just click on that and drag it to the left-hand side. So here I've actually clicked on it and I'm dragging the thing and dragging it from the extended desktop onto the main desktop. Another neat thing you can do with displays, and this is you don't have to have two displays to do this, but just an individual display, you can change the scaling. You can change the resolution, but you're better off to stick with the recommended resolution. But you can change the scaling, and what that does is it changes the size of things. So on this particular computer, it's decided that it's recommending I should use 125%. Rather than what you might imagine would be 100%. So if you change the scale and you have a number of different options which are built in, you can go 100 to 175% in 25% increments. What it does is it makes the icons bigger, the captions for the icons are bigger, and so for older people like me, everything gets easier to read. But by the same token, they take up more real estate. So it changes the size of the icons, and the problem with that is, of course, you've got a limited amount of desktop, so as they get bigger, they tend to move around to fill up different lines. We'll take a look at that in a second. And if you have an application open, then the text will generally scale, and so again, the larger text will be generally easier to read. So if you have a big monitor with a high resolution and everything's kind of tiny, so scaling the desktop is one way to make things easier to actually read. Application windows and the taskbar icons also generally scale, so they'll get bigger. And graphic elements like control buttons and sliders in applications will also get bigger. So it's a preferential thing. If you like it kind of as it was, then stick with that. If you like it scaled, then play around and try a different scale. So here's my main monitor, and this is running at 100%. And you maybe can see here that I've got various rows of icons, and in general, the icons are running four icons per row, if you like. If I now scale that monitor to 125%, you can see that the icons get bigger. And because they get bigger and they have to fit still in that desktop space that's available, then it shifts them around. So instead of rows of four icons now, I basically have rows of five icons. So as I say, it's just a preferential thing, with what you like, whether you like big icons and taking up a bit more real estate, or small icons that you can't read very well. I said that applications generally scale, and here's an example where I'm looking at Notepad. In the top is the display at 100%, and in the bottom you've got a display scaled to 125%, and you can see that the text is bigger, but I've got less lines now. Instead of having 22, 23 lines almost in the window, in the same size window, I've only got 19 lines. but I can read the text much easier. And another thing you might want to do is, again, if you've just got a single monitor, you can do this. You can actually change the background. So if you go to, if you right-click on the desktop, and in this case, select Personalize, which is one of the Windows settings, and then you get some options to what image you want to use. That's the menu on the left here. So you can choose a solid color, you can choose a picture, and you've got these various slideshow spotlight type things, which are weird and wonderful. And then once you've decided that you want a picture, let's say, you can choose how to make it fit on the actual page. And you have to play around with these and see what's going to work best for you. Generally, I think fill is probably what you would use. You fill the whole screen with the chosen image. But I decided to play around and see what happens. So here's a little image I use as an avatar, basically. It's Tux, the Linux Penguin. And I told it to actually fit this image to the background. And I set the background to be pure white. So you can see the black outline of the image there. If I change the fit to center, then it basically shows the image as kind of the real size, if you like. It's not a very big image, and it's basically stuck it right in the middle. And then what's the next one? Then the next one I chose was tile. I couldn't live with that one, but you can see it's basically just replicated the image all over the desktop and made a complete mess of things. So, like I say, what you really want to do probably is choose an image that you like. I like this one because it's at least got some texture to it, but it's not terribly overpowering in terms of I can still easily see all the various icons. And they don't get buried in all kinds of weird and wonderful parts of the graphic. And in this case, I chose it to fill the image. Screen resolution is 1920x1080, high def. The image is bigger than that, so it basically fills the image with the existing, or fills the screen with the image that's available. And then Chris points out that if you want to know more, everything there is to know essentially about using multiple displays, Paul Thurow had an article in June, and the URL there is there. He'll tell you all about multi-display setups, how to connect the secondary display, and how to configure things, and so on and so forth. So lots of information, and the beauty of playing around with the desktop background and stuff is if you don't like what you're doing, you just revert to what you had before. So it's a good place to experiment, see if you can find something that you prefer over the bog standard issue. Okay, yeah,
Steve pointed out that you can have two separate desktop backgrounds for two monitors, or I guess you can have a separate background for every monitor you have connected because it's not just two. You can actually have many, many monitors selected. And Tom points out that you can have a slideshow or a folder of JPEGs, and with several monitors, different images will play successively on each as a background. And okay. Jeff points out if scaling creates an icon size or icon spacing issue, you can always tinker with icon spacing, vertical and horizontal, and size using RegEdit. There are utilities around, too, that will let you play with that without having to go to RegEdit to do the changes.
Okay, very good. All right, so the next thing is a share from Chris.
Okay, whoops. Yeah, so I almost didn't do this. I've had this in my to-do item for probably well over a year, and it seemed to be getting less and less useful, and so I was going to actually drop it. But then I found that it actually still is quite useful. So it's a web extension called Behind the Overlay. And if you ever get to a website and all of a sudden it throws something up over the top of the content that you have to interact with. So it might say, oh, you got to create an account on our site to access the content. or it might say, you know, you have to disable your ad blocker so they can monetize your existence on their site, or you have to watch a video or give them money or something. You have to do some interaction with it before you're able to actually access the content. So wouldn't it be really nice if you could just get rid of that overlay without doing anything that they are asking you to actually do? And you can do that with the Behind the Overlay browser extension sometimes. And this is why I almost didn't do it, because it doesn't work on sometimes, some of the websites. So I found when I first came across this a number of years ago, it worked almost universally. Now, well, it sort of works sometimes. So it's worth trying. So here's an example, Rotten Tomatoes. And so Rotten Tomatoes wants you to enable ads. And if you don't want to go and enable ads on the website, if you install the Behind the Overlay, you get that little icon on the extensions section of the toolbar, and you just click on that, and then all of a sudden the overlay is gone, and you can just access the content. Or how about this one, 5-Day Deals. This is a photography site, and they have this 5-Day Deals where you can buy huge number of programs and extensions to photo programs and services and all kinds of stuff like that. But you can't even see the deals until you actually subscribe to it. And I'm a little bit loath to subscribe to anything. They want your email address. Are they going to flood you with crap emails and things like that? Well, if you have the Behind the Overlay, all of a sudden the overlay is gone and I can actually see what all the deals are, and then I can decide whether I want to actually subscribe to that website or not. Or how about this, PBS? You know, they had Free Press as cornerstone and they want you to give money. And if you click on Behind the Overlay, it goes away and then you don't have to worry about that. And so, for Chromium-based browsers, so Google Chrome, Edge, Vivaldi, Brave, so forth, there's the link for it, and I will paste that in. And if you have Firefox, of course, it requires different coding for it, and so at the Mozilla site, you can actually download it from there. And the icon should appear on the browser toolbar once you do that. And if it doesn't, click on the extensions icon, and that will allow you to click on the, go down, scroll down to Behind the Overlay, click on the pin, and then it will appear on the toolbar, and then it's one click away anytime you get an overlay. As I said, lots of times it doesn't work, but when it does work, it's a real joy. So that's all I have on that.
Okay, so Tom has a couple of other options. He points out that there's an extension called UMatrix, which if you use that in Firefox, you can turn off scripts and images and text by domain name. And uBlock Origin allows you to hide different page parts, including overlays. So there's a couple of applications that will do the same kind of things. I guess you have to set it up though.
uBlock Origin is good for Firefox. It gives you a lot of power. You can do kind of the same thing in Chrome or Chromium browsers, but it's more limited.
Yeah, Elizabeth also mentioned some websites limit the amount of text one can read, and I have never found that Behind the Overlay does anything for those. So Paul Thurrott's websites are that way. One interesting thing about Paul Thurrott's website, you get down to the part where it just sort of fades out, and then it says to read further, you have to subscribe to the site, and you have to pay money. But with Paul Thurrott, it seems like he gives about 95% of the content, or better. And it's just that tiny little extra bit at the end that you actually don't see if you are not a subscriber. So he gives an awful lot of his information away for free, and then he just tries to entice you to actually subscribe by cutting off a tiny, tiny little bit of it.
Okay, next up I have a recommendation for a YouTube video. I've always been fascinated by Raspberry Pis. I've never owned one. One of these days I'll get one, but I haven't. But this is a video basically talking about how the Raspberry Pi was developed and what it did for the computing world. So it goes way back when to how it was essentially based on the BBC Acorn computer and how they developed single board computer, essentially, credit size thing, and then later on the Pi Zero and that kind of stuff. So the whole history of Raspberry Pi here. If you have any interest in Raspberry Pis, single board computers, then it's actually a neat little video. And if anybody out there is a Raspberry Pi aficionado, I'd love you to consider giving a presentation for the user group. I don't think we've ever had a presentation on Raspberry Pi exclusively, and I think there are a number of people who'd be interested in that. So, if you're interested in Raspberry Pi and would like to give us a presentation, we'd like to hear from you. Okay, next up, Chris, a question.
Yeah, this came in from Marilyn. I see a Marilyn on the participant list. I don't know if it's the Marilyn who sent in this this particular. Oh, she's disappeared.
It is I.
Oh, okay. okay, so you can chime in if you want at any time. So this got sent into suggestion box, and Marilyn has a laptop running Windows 10. And it is on the Extended Security Updates program. And after the latest Windows 10 monthly updates, on the reboot, it ended up with a red screen saying secure boot violation, invalid signature detected, check secure boot policy in setup. And Marilyn noted that on checking, secure boot policy is enabled and is wondering why it happened. Will you need a USB reboot or any suggestions on how to proceed? And so I took a quick look at it, and I asked Perplexity what it thought of that particular error message, and it came up saying that it's usually a secure boot trust problem, not actually an update failure. And the most practical fixes, restore the firmware's default secure boot keys, and it gave instructions on exactly where you go in the UEFI in order to do that. They also said perhaps switching the BIOS UEFI boot back to its expected setting. It didn't really talk about the expected setting. I didn't really know what they were talking about there. And then they also said, or temporarily disable secure boot so the machine can boot. And I bolded that for a reason. Because after I got that response back from it, I thought, maybe this was actually due to the fact that the secure boot certificates expired and it was being rolled out over a period of time, I believe, but it is happening now. And so Microsoft themselves say that expired certificates should not prevent the computer from booting. And they said should. They didn't say wouldn't wouldn't prevent the computer. They said it shouldn't prevent. So I looked around a little bit more, and explaining computers, we've had a number of presentations at Q&A on the gentleman who does that, and he has a lot more information on the expiring certificates. And I didn't paste that in. I will paste that in to the chat right now, so you'll have that URL as well. And I think that the long and short of it was that maybe the best idea is to disable secure boot in UEFI or the BIOS, and that should actually get things working if it really is about the secure boot certificates. So that could be the best thing that could happen. Now, since then, Marilyn actually did reply to that. And Marilyn, maybe you could chime in with what your results were and the things you tried.
Yes, so I did try for that secure boot policy to see if I can switch it from enabled to disabled, and it's possible, except that it came back with a big warning screen that, are you really sure you want to do this, because it may stop your computer from booting or, you know, getting the installation right. So I kind of chickened out.
Yeah, I mean, anybody else, please chime in if you actually think that this would be an issue. My understanding is that disabling secure boot would not mean your computer can't boot. And even if it did happen, then you could always go back into UEFI and turn it back on again. So that's my understanding of how it would work. If anybody has a different idea to that, please, please, please chime in and, you know, let us know what you think is going on, or is it safe to disable secure boot? I think it should be safe to turn it off, at least to get your computer up and running, and then look into getting the secure boot certificates actually updated on your computer. You probably will want to check with the manufacturer of your computer and see what they have to say about, on Windows 10, how to get the secure boot certificates installed. The Explaining Computers video explains that once you get your computer back up and running, it explains how you can go and see whether you have the updated certificates or not. And he has some advice on how to get them updated if they haven't been updated. But, you know, the whole idea of secure boot being turned off, it will protect you against certain, you know, malware that could get onto your computer that is uses the boot process to be able to get in underneath the operating system, shall we say. But the likelihood of you getting hit by that is, first off, I think pretty low. Alan tells me that he turned it off, secure boot off, years ago when he had a problem dual booting with Linux and has never turned it back on. Alan, you want to chime in on how comfortable you feel running without secure boot?
It's run perfectly for years and years. I've never bothered with it. At one point, you had to turn it off to install Linux, and then later on, you had to use some kind of shim process to deal with it, and I could never be bothered. I didn't see the point, so I just left it turned off.
Yeah, and I certainly think that if you can turn it off, at least to get to the point where you can get your computer back up and running, and then if you can get the updated boot certificates installed, then you could go back in, turn it back on again, and you wouldn't get that scary message on boot. So is there anybody who thinks that it's really not a good idea to actually go ahead and disable secure boot in the UEFI?
I know you can do it. I did it quite a lot. I was trying to get the certificates for Bazite, which is an immutable distro of Linux. And I wanted it to be able to run with the secure boot with Windows 11. So the first time I went in to adjust the UEFI and the secure boot, I had to enter it in administrator mode with a username and password and all that sort of stuff. The second time I had to go into it, I took out the password and the user admin and all that sort of stuff, and it just turned it into a toggle. So I could turn the secure boot on or I could turn it off. And I was able to get a certificate for the Bazite boot and for the bootable media for Macrium Reflect as well, so that my backups could be restored.
Yeah. So Tom has a good question. Does Windows 11 require secure boot? And I think it does to install it. I'm not sure if it needs to be in place after the fact. After installation, I don't know if you actually need secure boot or not.
I'm just looking at hardware info on my Windows computer, and it's in red, so I guess it's turned off.
Okay.
No problems here.
Yeah. So, okay, the process then that I think would probably be the best, chime in anybody if you think it's wrong, would be start off with going into the UEFI, disable secure boot, and see if the computer boots. If it doesn't, go into UEFI, turn it back on, and I think you'll still be in that same position, though. So you're not going to be able to boot. And then if you disable secure boot in the UEFI, and you can boot into Windows, then you can go watch that Explaining Computers YouTube video and see what they say about how to check out the current status of your Secure Boot certificates and how to get them updated, if at all possible. And some of it might even be going to the manufacturer of the motherboard or the computer, if it's a name brand computer, and getting their instructions on how to get those updated. And then once you get them updated, then trying to turn on Secure Boot again in the UEFI. If nobody chimes in with...
Will Windows 11 run fine without having to have...
Okay, well, this is a Windows 10 computer.
Yeah, this is the old laptop I have. So I have a Windows 11, but it's still kind
of... Yeah, but you don't need Secure Boot at all then.
Exactly. No. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. I want to keep my Windows 10 laptop running. I use it for other stuff.
Yeah, no reason not to. So I think that message you got when you tried to turn off Secure Boot and it gave you that scary message saying that your computer might not boot, I think that's just an error. That's just bogus.
My own experience with that is that I tried to install Linux on my Acer laptop. It's a gaming PC, and it runs Windows 11, and I turned off Secure Boot in order to be able to install Linux. But Windows 11, when it came back, when I booted it up, it absolutely insisted on having it and turned it back on again.
Oh, so, okay.
I have no idea what effect it has on Linux once you have that installed, but I kind of stopped right there to kind of like think about it.
Yeah, okay. So it looks like if it was Windows 11, trying to turn off Secure Boot is not a good idea, but given that this is a Windows 10 computer, I don't think there'll be any issue with turning off Secure Boot. So, Marilyn, if you wanted to try that out and report back to us on success or failures that you have, that would be appreciated.
Yeah, I shall do that. Certainly a little bit more reassurance.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll try it tonight.
A good thing to do is to have an AI on your phone while you're doing it. Then you can ask the phone AI what you need in order to get...
Marilyn has another computer as well, so having another computer that you can query about any error messages you get is a good thing, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Marilyn.
I'll let you know.
Okay, good discussion. All right, so next up we have a question for all you people who've gone over to the dark side. And I'll just remind you that we used to be the IBM PC and Compatibles user group or something. And so we don't really deal with Macs, but this question came in, and I know some people use iPads, and I know some people have iPhones, and I'm sure somebody must have an iMac out there. So Stephen here has an old Mac which died. He bought a new one, which is working well, but he wants to get the data from the old Mac onto the new one. So is there somewhere that he can go to take the old drive out? Or can you use YouTube University, which tells you how to do it? That's what I would do. Is there some kind of cable that he can purchase and transfer the data from the old hard drive to the new Mac computer? And so does anybody have any insights on data transfer between Mac computers?
So, Stephen, I'm presuming, Stephen, that you don't have a Time Machine backup of that old Mac?
Well, I did, but it started going funny about, 8 months ago. So the last number of months hasn't been. And there might be some issues in getting even the further back stuff from the Time Machine, but it should all still be on the hard drive in that one, so I should get it.
Yeah.
But it couldn't happen at a worse time, and I don't know that it's really something that needs a data scraper. I'm assuming it's just to do with the operating system, not like the whole hard drive being corrupted or physically destroyed. But, I mean, that remains to be seen. But I've been told by some people, IT people that I know, that the so-called data scrapers will just financially destroy me Whereas if I could just get the hard drive taken out, I mean, I can give the old iMac and someone can use it for parts that they like. I don't want a penny from that. I just want to get data.
Yeah. So does anybody on the call have any experience with getting data off of a hard drive on a Mac that was installed on another computer and getting access to the data on a new computer?
I have a little bit of experience. I updated my ex-wife got a new computer, and I took out the old hard drive. Actually, what I did is I took out the hard drive from her. This was a Intel Mac, MacBook. And I took that out and I replaced it with an SSD. This was a birthday present or something. And then, but before that, I copied all the information over onto the SSD before I put it into her. This is a, you know, two and a quarter inch, SATA SSD. So not a stick. And I didn't have a problem. You can get, these housings or even just a cable from like computer stores that will allow you to connect up to your new Mac. But I do have a caveat. I know that the latest MacBooks and iMacs actually have a kind of a soldered in hard drive that you cannot update at all. So I don't know how new your old Mac is, and if it's too new, you might not be able to take the old hard drive out.
The one that died, the old iMac, that was fairly old. I think it was like 2018, so it's got a few years on it. So I think that it doesn't have that problem. But still, as someone who has not monkeyed around taking an iMac apart and hooking up cables and that, I mean, I'm completely unaware of how to do anything. But first, I guess it starts with getting the darn hard drive and or cards, whatever else would be part of it, out. And then somehow at that point, either myself or someone can at least copy it onto something, like buy them a hard drive
external USB drive.
Yeah, or like, let's see, and say, here, just dump everything on there, and then I can sort through it after, but I at least want to get access to the data.
Well, my suggestion is, as was earlier suggested, take a look at some YouTube videos for the vintage of your iMac, and see what kind of mass storage it has, whether it's an SSD or a hard drive, and take a look and see if it is you should be able to find out whether or not you can take it out and then attach it to a cable or a housing. The cables or housings are usually about like $20-25 at the computer stores.
Well, that would be extremely reasonable. I'd be happy as a pig, and you know what, if that were the case.
Alice had a question in the chat, or more comment, I guess, saying people at the Apple Store can't suggest a tech support service.
No, they were very unhelpful. They wouldn't do it, and they didn't really suggest any particular places. So I was a little disappointed with them, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
Okay, well, if anybody has any suggestions, put it in the chat and we'll follow up. Okay, next question came in. A member here is looking for websites that will allow her to download photos for free so she can use them in a book, or websites that sell photographs for reasonable amounts of money. So if people have options for that. And the one that comes to my mind, I put it in the chat there, is Pixabay.com. They have lots of images which are royalty-free, but I caution you that not all of the images on their website are royalty-free. So just be careful what you download. I guess you won't be able to download the other ones unless you pay for
them. Do
you have any other suggestions?
Yes.
Daniel, I muted you. One of the things that I've noticed is some of the search engines will allow you to choose access rights, and so you can search for, you know, photo parliament buildings, whatever it is you're looking for, and then under the access rights, you could choose public domain or Creative Commons license or whatever license you're looking for. Public domain is certainly the most broad, so you might try doing that for searching for your photographs. There definitely are sites that will sell photographs for well under $70 to $100. I guess it, part of it would be depending on the use that you're actually going to put it to, but you'd have to check with the licensing agreement wherever you pick up something that is licensed photography to check what the terms and conditions are for that.
And just a caution on those websites that let you filter for public domain, they don't.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I should have mentioned that too. It's like even they say, you know, you have to. It's up to you to double check. Google Images tells you that it will do that, but they don't guarantee it. And so it's up to you to validate that it is actually public domain or Creative Commons license or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. Next up, Chris, you have a Loony Link.
Yes, I do. This is kind of a funny one. Canadian Prime Minister's Simulator. And I got a kick out of this. It's you tabled your policy, and three provinces swung, and a confidence vote is looming, and can you succeed, or will your government actually be defeated? And so it's an AI-powered political sandbox. You can basically type in any policy that you want to enact, and then you watch reactions as they come in. You'll get different Canadian voters weighing in on what they think about it. There are stakeholder groups, so there might be non-governmental organizations, various things like that that will weigh in, and then you will get weigh in from all 13 provinces and territories. And so it's free to start, and so the premium is £5.99 per month. And so this may be why it's a Loony Link in name only, because even though I'm from Canada, it was charging me in British pounds, but it is all about Canadian prime ministers. So it unlocks other things like full mandate, unlimited careers, and they say advanced simulation modes without going into an awful lot of detail about it. I went in and I just played around with it. And so I started off and says Canada in 2025, liberal minority, housing crisis, U.S. tariffs, Indigenous reconciliation, minority survival. So those are the sort of criteria that you have to actually deal with. And then you can create your own prime minister. Well, that's a premium one, so I'm stuck with Carney whether I wanted it or not. Then you have the character set up, so you can actually change a whole bunch of aspects of the prime minister. Not that I think that age or race or things like that should have an awful lot to do with simulation. And then you have a starting position. And so you have polling information, the number of seats in the House and the Senate, what your approval rating is at that point in time, international relationships, how they rate, and so forth. And then you start playing. And your first challenge comes along. And so here I have flooding, devastating southern Quebec. 30,000 people are displaced and 4 are dead. And so what are you going to do about this? And so I decide to send in the Canadian forces to help with cleanup. I announce a policy that affected people will be able to defer their federal income tax for a year, and announce that the provincial government is taking the lead. Federal government stands ready to provide additional assistance as required. So that's what I came up with as a response. And I submit that policy. And then it comes up with some initial analysis for it. So it has an executive summary of what's going on, key implementation risks that involve with that, what are the fiscal impacts. You know, I did say we were going to defer taxes for affected people for a year, so what's going to be the effect of that? Delivery and politics, how complex is this, and how does the public sensitivity weigh in? And then what the Prime Minister's office recommends. And then you start getting in the feedback from the press. And then you get favorability reactions come in, and then you get different stakeholder groups and so forth are weighing in with what their reaction is and so forth. And then at the end of the first term, you have a new favorability rating, your polling, your stability, and so forth, and then you play for another month. And so that's about as far as I got with it. So if you have a bent towards these sort of simulators, check it out. That's it.
Okay, thanks, thanks, Chris. There's a number of suggestions about photographs in the chat. And we've had lots of discussion about various things, but we are into that last 10. In fact, we're in the last 5, I guess. So if people have additional questions, now is the time to raise your hand electronically or open your microphone and try not to talk over everybody else.
And you can also raise your hand if you want. We'll try to keep an eye on the
so there's a
gallery.
Question in here. I could only find it in this chat window.
I've got it. I have a media player, MyGiga ATV 495, a few years old, not using it anymore. Can it be used for anything else? Does anyone use these things nowadays? I can tell you that I end up doing that just to rip CDs and get them onto my computer. That's about all I've ever used media players, presuming you're talking about a CD or DVD player. That's about all I've used mine for in quite a few years, actually.
Okay. This thing is just slightly bigger than a credit card, like two credit cards put together, so it doesn't play any disc.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, and it's... it's just sitting here, and I'm going through the house throwing things out, so I don't know what I should do with this. It's somebody, well, I mean, I have used it in the past, but not for quite a few years now, at least 5 years. So, you know, it's just that when somebody mentioned the Raspberry Pi, I'm thinking this thing, you know, has a lot of stuff in it that probably can do something, but, you know, I hate to give it to Best Buy. But anyways, we'll see.
Is it more than just a music player?
It's the thing that you connect to the internet with, and then you can watch television shows and movies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, you have to use. Well, when I did use it a long time ago, I had to kind of connect it via Kodi.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, this Kodi thing, it's an application,
yeah.
But it's all sort of open source, user maintained, and so things just kept changing, and some things worked and some things didn't work, so I gave up on it. But anyway, I'll look into it more now that I've pulled it out of the basement.
Good luck.
Okay, Natalie had raised her hand too. Go ahead, Natalie.
Just a quick question. So I'm going to be upgrading my Windows 10 laptop, and I actually have another PC to replace my old one that has Windows 11. So I haven't done the setup, but is it necessary to do the setup where you have the login, whatever, with the Microsoft account? Or can I circumvent that? Because with my Windows 10, I don't have it the initial login linked. And so, you know, it always tells me, oh, your Microsoft account is not blah, blah, blah. But I don't want that. And so is that necessary in Windows 11, or can I not have that?
I know they're making it more and more difficult to set up a new computer with Windows 11 without using Microsoft account. But I think you should be able to do an upgrade. If you're upgrading from 10 to 11, I think you should be able to do it from any administrator account on the computer, and it'll do the upgrade, and then you will end up with your accounts in exactly the same state that they were under Windows 10.
Okay, so it's the new computer that I might be stuck with.
Yeah, if it's a new installation, and there are workarounds for it, but quite frankly, what I would do on even on any new Windows 11, I would just go along with what Microsoft wants you to do, and set up a. It's not necessarily a bad thing to have a Microsoft account on your computer. It will be an administrator account. And then the first thing, and if you want, the only thing you have to do when you log into that account for the first time is go into settings, accounts, and other accounts, and add a local account, and add the account that you want to use for your day-to-day use. Set it as an administrator, and then you you can just use that other account. The fact that there is a Microsoft account that happens to be sitting on your computer that is an administrator account is of little consequence. And if anything, it does provide you with some extra capabilities. For one thing, the BitLocker keys for the disk encryption will be stored in the OneDrive account for that first account that gets set up on your computer. So you can always get to that if you are ever prompted with, oh, secure boot has failed, and please put in your BitLocker key. And then you can go to any computer, log into your Microsoft account that you used to set up the Windows 11 in the first place, and you'll be able to access the BitLocker key there.
Okay, thank you.
Carol says that she's found an old iPhone SE, but can't remember the passcode. Does anybody know how to recover the passcode, and can an Apple Store agent help? Again, another question for you. That starts IDEBO.
I know iPhones, for quite a long time, the iPhones have been doing encryption on the device. And so in all likelihood, that would imply that you would not be able to recover it.
The Apple Store won't be able to help you, but if you took pictures on it, they may be synced to the iCloud account associated with it. So try to look there. Or if you backed it up on your computer or some other device, then the photos might be there.
The other thing you could do is contact the NSA in the States. I hear that they can get access to anything on an iPhone.
Okay, thank you.
I'm being a little facetious in case anybody didn't recognize that.
I got it.
I think the OPT, I think, has bought one of those Israeli phone.
Yeah, that's true. The Israelis can do it, too. Yeah.
So call the OPT.
Yeah, or the Mossad in Israel. Yeah, I think Alan said, or whoever's suggestion it was, of checking the iCloud account associated with that phone, the photos might be backed up there, or there might be more data backed up there as well.
Yeah, I think this phone is pre-iCloud time, but okay, thanks.
Okay.
You can still use the phone, but when you reset it, it gets rid of all the storage on it. But then you can reuse the phone or sell it.
And Gail said a word salad here. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, but I think you cannot recover the pin on an iPhone. So I'm not sure what you really meant by that, Gail.
Yes, you cannot recover your pin.
Okay.
It's my guess.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Wrap up. And this is actually a quote from somebody when we did a membership survey quite some time ago. This was talking about Q&As. Much of what is discussed goes right over my head. So there's a question. I mean, Chris and I, we keep pulling out these topics that we share with people, and they're generally things that interest us or things that we do, but it's not necessarily the things that you'd like to know about. So the problem is we don't know what you need to know. So are there questions that you'd like answered? If you think they're too basic, then they're not. All levels of questions are welcome. Most of them we can't answer, so somebody else will be able to. And you can always send your question to suggestion box, and we'll do our best to answer it or find somebody who can. So if you have questions or topics that you would like to hear about, just let us know. And next week is the 29th, next Wednesday. That will be our next Q&A. We're having Q&As throughout the summer as long as we keep getting questions, hint. So send us your questions, any follow-up you have on the information we provided tonight, the topics that came up for discussion. If you have a topic that you'd like to share rather than Chris and I sharing it, make up a few slides, tell us what you want to do, and we'll add you into the agenda. So anything you want to know about, anything you want to tell us about, send us some details to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. I hope everybody enjoyed tonight. Good presentations, good discussion, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
And just to follow on with what Alan was saying, as you're browsing around, as you're using your computer, you know, think, hey, could other people, you know, be interested in this? Or are there some people out there that, you know, might find some value in what I do or what I came across on the web or anything like that at all? That's usually, you know, that's how I come up with the ideas that I have for shares. It's usually just, you know, something I come across and I'm reading, I think, oh, other people might like to know this too, maybe. Why not? So, we'll see y'all next week, folks.